This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Well, today we are interviewing John Marvel. He's Vice President of the Sagebrush Habitat Conservation Fund, and he's in Haley, Idaho. So welcome, John. It's great to be talking with you. We want to find out about the Sagebrush Fund.
Thanks, Jay. I appreciate your interest.
Oh, good. Why don't you tell us what the Sagebrush Fund is all about and how it came into being?
Sure. The Sagebrush Habitat Conservation Fund was created in 2010 as part of a settlement between Western Watersheds Project, of which I was the executive director at the time, and the El Paso Corporation in Houston, which was building a natural gas pipeline between Wyoming and Oregon called the Ruby Pipeline. Ruby seemed to think that Western Watersheds might litigate the final approval by the BLM of the pipeline route. We actually had no intention of doing that. We're surprised when we were contacted by El Paso, and we negotiated with them over several months and eventually reached an agreement where we agreed not to sue them, to put this money into the new conservation fund, and the only requirement on that was that it couldn't be used for litigation.
So the Sagebrush Habitat Conservation Fund, it actually came into being prior to that Ruby Pipeline issue, is that right?
No, it was created out of the negotiations.
Okay. So that's what actually stimulated the formation.
Yes, it was the litigation record of Western Watersheds Project that alarmed the gas people.
And was that settlement a notable breakthrough? Was that kind of the first of its kind?
Well, I don't really know the answer to that. It certainly was for our group, Western Watersheds Project, and it's been put to good use since then. The main purpose of the fund is to retire federal grazing permits in sagebrush habitat.
So how did you get involved? Were you one of the initial people who put it together, or did you join a pre-existing group or what?
No, I'm the founder of Western Watersheds Project, Jay.
Oh, I see.
In 1993. And I was the person who negotiated the agreement with El Paso Corporation in 2010.
So what's your background?
Well, I'm a licensed architect. Been living in Idaho for 56 years. I grew up on the East Coast. I have degrees in American history and a master's in architecture. And I've been practicing architecture here since 1975 and still do a little bit, but mostly I do conservation work.
So what got you into working on sagebrush? What was the attraction there?
Well, it was primarily my realization that the entire American West has been subjected to the pillaging of domestic livestock for more than 140 years, and as a consequence, the environment has suffered tremendously and continues to in most of the arid West.
What's important about sagebrush?
Well, sagebrush constitutes the overstory plant in the sage steppe landscape, which occurs in 11 western states of the U.S., also into Canada and Mexico. And it's a ubiquitous habitat for many life forms, but it's been severely degraded in most places and destroyed altogether. and millions of acres in other places. So it's in a diminished state now.
Are there either domestic animals or wildlife that actually feed off of sagebrush?
Domestic sheep will eat sagebrush if they're really hungry. Cattle will not eat sagebrush unless they're starving.
Uh-huh.
In terms of wildlife, there are some sagebrush obligate species that couldn't survive without certain kinds of sagebrush, and that includes pygmy rabbits, sage grouse, and pronghorn antelope.
So sagebrush forms a habitat for those animals that depend on it.
Absolutely. There's the sage grouse might be considered the umbrella species in the sage steppe landscape, and there are many, many others. Sage sparrows, brewer sparrows, sage thrashers. There's different kinds of lizards and voles that only exist in sage steppe landscapes.
So coming west from the Mississippi River, where do you first encounter sagebrush?
Really, it's the classic move west when you cross the 100th Meridian, which is in western Nebraska and the Dakotas, and Oklahoma and Texas. You start to encounter sagebrush, and it was reported by Lewis and Clark on their trip west as a new environment to them.
So you don't find it further east. It's not located anywhere east of the Mississippi, right?
Well, I can't speak for sure. As a general habitat type, I would say no. There may be some species of sagebrush, which is the genus Artemisia, east of the Mississippi River or in the Great Plains, but I'm not that familiar with those areas.
What kind of soil is required for sagebrush to flourish?
Well, we have to acknowledge that there's more than 25 different kinds of sagebrush in western North America, and each one has a specific soil and altitude locational needs. And so it varies a lot, but typically the most consistent factor for the presence of sagebrush is arid landscapes. In other words, places where it's very dry.
And why is that?
It co-evolved with the western landscape of dry lands that were noted by many, many people, and also by the Native Americans who lived in them and were dependent on different food sources than Native Americans in the eastern U.S. So it's a big part of the American continent and unacknowledged, sometimes regarded as an unnecessary vegetative type. And there's a lot of folklore that sagebrush is not even native in the West, and that's completely untrue.
So if you have too much rainfall, sagebrush can't adapt to it.
No, it won't.
And you mentioned wildlife species. Is anything you left out that sagebrush supports?
Well, I just
sparrows
reiterate these special species that are totally dependent on the presence of sagebrush, pronghorns, pygmy rabbits, sage grouse, and a suite of sage steppe birds. Without the sage steppe landscape, they could not exist.
Okay, so there are multiple species of sagebrush, multiple types of sagebrush. What are they and how do they differ?
Well, they differ in size, in the structure of the flowers, in the soil types they exist in, and the altitude at which they grow. So if you have a mountain big sagebrush grows at higher elevation than basin big sagebrush, you have three-tip sagebrush, and you have low sagebrush, which never grows higher than about 10 or 12 inches. All these are located where conditions support that coevolutionary process that created those vegetation.
Mm-hmm. So is sagebrush limited by the elevation at which you find it?
Yes. Some will not grow above a certain elevation. Others will only grow high in the mountains.
Uh-huh.
So it varies a lot. So some are more capable of existing in wetter landscapes that we find in the American West, but not, say, west of the Cascade Mountains.
Uh-huh. So what is really special about sagebrush? I gather it's because of the habitat that it creates that you are so concerned about saving it?
Well, because it's a very large area of the West that's been degraded by things people have done over many, many decades. But in the scale of evolution, it's only about 150 years of degradation in most of the West in sage steppe habitat. So it's recoverable to a better condition, unlike some other habitats which have been completely wiped out.
So how does it reproduce itself?
Seeds.
Yeah. And how long does it take for a seed to turn into a viable bush?
It's very slow to recover from fire, say, or from stripping by for livestock benefits or agriculture. A full sagebrush plant may take 40 years to recover.
Oh, wow. What has threatened sagebrush? Has it been agricultural land being developed, or what are the principal threats to sagebrush?
Well, there's plenty of them, but human activities are the largest negative impact, especially the introduction and maintenance of domestic livestock in the American West. Livestock destroy sagebrush themselves, and also humans destroy sagebrush to try and produce more grass for livestock.
The fund has been in place for about a decade?
15 years.
15 years. And what are its notable accomplishments?
Well, the Sagebrush Fund has successfully retired about 1.2 million acres of federal grazing permits in sage steppe landscapes in five different states. So that's the biggest accomplishment.
One of your acquisitions, or one of the places you have acquired permits, is the Lava Lake acquisition, which is up near Ketchum, north of you. Tell us about
that. That's right. The Lava Lake grazing retirement was 88,000 acres. This was accomplished 5 years ago. And it was four domestic sheep grazing allotments north and northeast of Ketchum, Idaho, on two different national forests. And plenty of sagebrush in those allotments, plus beautiful now riparian areas and aspen clones. It's a very beautiful landscape, getting better every year.
So I gather that a rancher, to have his cattle use the landscape, they acquire a permit, they purchase a permit from the Forest Service, is that right?
Or maybe they inherit it.
But it's somewhere back there. How was it acquired? It was purchased from the Forest Service.
Well, no, they're not purchased. They're permits that give the right to use an area for livestock grazing, which is the most ubiquitous human use in the entire Western North America. Covers more land than any other single use and has more deleterious effects on the landscape than any other human use.
Wow.
And so grazing permits exist all over the West on public lands and state lands, and ranchers are charged very little on federal lands, it's $1.35 a month for a cow and a calf, eating probably 1,000 pounds of forage. So a domestic sheep gets charged 27 cents a month.
So with the current administration, I would expect that they'd want to raise the grazing fees.
Well, I'm glad we both have a sense of humor, because there's a great deal of irony about Republicans and their desire for cutting the federal budget deficit when it comes to environmental conditions, where ranchers have been getting free handout essentially for decades. They show no interest in raising that fee. Can you imagine?
So the Sagebrush Fund just completed a grazing retirement of a large allotment in Dinosaur National Monument along the Colorado-Utah border. Tell us about that success.
Well, National Monument in the past, and this one in particular, is overseen by the National Park Service, and many national monuments have been converted by Congress into national parks. And in this case, the grazing allotment on Dinosaur National Monument were grandfathered in when it was created more than 60 years ago. And they're due to expire on the death of a final person identified at that time in the family. And this particular allotment is the largest in Dinosaur, and was permitted for many years to the Mantle family that owned an inholding on the Yampa River just inside the Colorado border. And we made this deal with Steve Mantle, the only surviving son under law who can hold this permit. And it would expire when he died, which could be anywhere from 10 to 30 years from now, since he's in his early 60s. But he was willing to go now, and that's a good deal for him. It's a good deal for the public lands in Dinosaur.
So you have a staff that negotiates. Who does the work on negotiating these deals?
Well, in the case of the Colorado River watershed, which is where Dinosaur is located, we have a retired BLM professional from Price, Utah. S. Willis, who negotiated this retirement for the Sagebrush Fund, and he works under contract.
So what's your source of funds then for whatever expenses you have?
The funds come from the Ruby Pipeline settlement of 2010.
I see. Okay, and that's it, huh?
Well, it's a lot of money, Jay, and so we're not pressed to continue to raise money, even though people do make contributions to the fund. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So the original amount of money is still largely available.
So you work in, you mentioned five states. I was thinking Wyoming, Montana, Idaho were about it, but what are the other two? The Dakotas, maybe?
Deals in Nevada, Utah, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and Oregon.
Okay. And how do you evaluate those permits when you how do you find out about permits that might be acquired, and how do you evaluate them as to whether you want to make the effort to acquire?
Well, we always go look at the landscape where the permit might be available. Not all ranchers want to sell to a conservation group, of course. And it's kind of a protected world out there. But we're very familiar after many years of the value of grazing permits to ranchers in particular, and the value of those grazing permits to us as a conservation organization if they're retired. from livestock use. So it's a negotiated process.
And when you acquire these permits, do you acquire them indefinitely into the future, or is there a term limit on them? How does the time factor?
No. We don't keep the permits. Typically, they're waived without preference by the rancher who we pay to do so. And the agency in charge of that permit retires them. The reason it's not as easy as we would like is because there are limited areas in the American West where the agency in charge of a particular area is obligated by law or proclamation to permanently retire permits for grazing that are waived without preference for another rancher. So, for example, in all of the national parks along the Colorado River and Utah, those are all eligible, and including the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area for permanent retirement. And also the recent national monuments created originally by Barack Obama, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. That was created by Bill Clinton, I guess. Those are eligible for permanent grazing retirement, too. And so if you strike a deal with a rancher, they waive their permit, the BLM in those cases has no choice. They're obligated to permanently retire them.
Oh, really? And do you have partners that you work with, other organizations that are involved?
Yes. We originally worked quite a lot with the National Wildlife Federation, their office in Missoula, Montana, which was actively seeking to retire grazing permits in the greater Yellowstone area because of conflicts with grizzly bears and wolves between livestock and those animals. And so we worked with Hank Fisher and his son, Kit Fisher, of the National Wildlife Federation. In Wyoming, we retired a suite of sheep grazing allotments to protect Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep. And we worked with the Wyoming Wild Sheep Foundation on those.
So you negotiate with landowners who hold the permits, is that right?
Yeah, ranchers.
Yeah.
Typical Western ranchers whose point of view may have changed. And, for example, if you're a sheep rancher in the West today, there's really not much point in being in business at all because the demand for wool and mutton is almost zero now. And so it's not a good business to be in.
So do you offer inducements, or are they just glad to give up their permits?
Oh, no, we pay the money. Cash money. It's a big incentive. If they want money, we can strike a deal.
Oh, that's great.
You know, what makes it easier is it breaks through these conflicts of the American West between conservation and ranching, because it's just a business deal. We don't have to agree with each other about anything else.
So what lies ahead? On your map, it shows you parcels identified in Idaho and Montana and Wyoming, I think. Do you have some prospects ahead in other places?
Well, we've been working through contract staff to try and strike deals with ranchers in southeast Utah, in particular, those national monuments I mentioned. In addition, the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument in southwest Oregon is eligible for permanent retirement. We're hopeful for a breakthrough there. The central Idaho and the Whitey County areas of Idaho both have retirement statutes in place for those wilderness areas and areas adjacent to wilderness. And so there are opportunities out there.
You know, one of the things I've been concerned about are in Utah particularly is that the state would like to acquire a lot of the federal lands, and under the current administration that conceivably could be in the works. When you've acquired a permit on a property, even if it were to transfer to the state, would that permit still persist?
Well, the permit has been retired permanently. So if the state acquired lands, and as you probably know, there was a lot of land exchange between the state of Utah and the BLM in Grand Staircase Escalante National.
Right.
And Utah, of course, did issue grazing permits on lands they acquired. But typically, those were to the ranchers that already were grazing there when they were BLM lands.
Uh-huh.
So if there was no grazing taking place, I suppose the state of Utah or other states could say we're reopening this to grazing, but we would probably fight them over it.
All right. The current administration budget cuts, you will not be affected by whether those happen or not.
Well, it may affect us because if the Forest Service and the BLM and the National Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are hollowed out, it will be difficult to get their attention.
Oh.
Because there'll be so few people working there.
Yeah. Okay, well, John, this has been great. Tell us what your website is.
It's sagebrushfund.org.
Ah, okay. So people can get more information about the Sagebrush Fund that way.
They certainly can,
yeah.
And we're always happy to talk to people, and especially if they are interested in retiring grazing
from. Right. Okay, well, John, thank you very much. It's been a great interview. I enjoyed it. So, thank you.
Thank you, Jay. I appreciate it.
Our guest today has been John Marvel, Vice President of the Sagebrush Habitat Conservation Fund, operating out of Haley, Idaho.
This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the Gallatin Wildlife Association and its activities can be found at its website, gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or go to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.